This is the Quality News Network. The evacuations continue in Lebanon, where an estimated 1,800 Americans were taken out today by military helicopter and aboard the cruise ship Orient Queen, all of them heading for Cyprus. Thousands more are scheduled to leave in the next couple of days, altogether about 6,000 by the weekend. In addition, 4,000 Danish citizens were evacuated today, along with thousands of nationals from other countries, including Australia, Belgium, Britain, Canada, Germany, and India. Israeli airstrikes today hit a Christian suburb in Beirut for the first time, but most of the airstrikes targeted southern Lebanon, killing as many as 57 Lebanese civilians. In addition, Israeli troops clashed with Hezbollah guerrillas on the Lebanese side of the border, leaving two Israeli soldiers dead, and a Hezbollah rocket hit a building in Nazareth, killing three people, including two children. In Gaza, six Palestinians have been killed after Israeli tanks moved into a refugee camp there. Another three Palestinians were killed in a separate incident in the West Bank. In Iraq today, at least 14 people killed, including a senior staff member of the Interior Ministry. And the Sunni Endowment Agency says more than 20 of its employees were kidnapped as they left work today in Baghdad. The United Nations reports that nearly 6,000 Iraqi citizens were killed during the months of May and June, coinciding with a rise in sectarian violence across that country. Two southern Afghan towns taken over by the Taliban earlier this week have now been retaken by Afghan and coalition forces. Indonesia has been hit with another earthquake, this one about 100 miles from the capital of Jakarta, but there are no reports of damage. On Java, the search continues for 300 people missing after a tsunami killed more than 500 earlier this week. Some relief today in the northeast from the summer heat, which has gripped much of the country this week. In the Midwest and southern plains, however, the thermometer is expected to top 100 in many locations. Western Europe is also sweltering with temperatures in the high 90s. Dozens of cruise ship passengers in Florida injured yesterday when, shortly after leaving Port Canaveral, their ship, the Crown Princess, suddenly listed badly to one side, throwing passengers and the crew to the deck. More than 80 were injured, two of them critically. President Bush expected to issue the first veto of his presidency today, a bill to expand federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has given initial approval to universal health care for all of its residents, the first city in the country to do so. And thousands of Australian children will soon be weighed and measured as part of that government's anti-obesity campaign. Australia estimates that up to a quarter of its children between the ages of 7 and 15 are overweight. This is the Quality News Network. Business news coming up.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke was on Capitol Hill today telling Congress that rising oil prices are a concern, but that the economy seems to be moderating and that inflation remains contained. U.S. consumer prices increased a moderate 0.2% in June, the smallest gain in 4 months, but the improvement is expected to be short-lived, with Middle East events pushing crude oil higher. J.P. Morgan reports that its net income more than tripled in the second quarter, and Bank of America reports an 18% hike in its second quarter earnings. General Dynamics earnings for the second quarter up 84%, and American Airlines parent company reports a 12.5% increase in second quarter profits. Southwest Airlines' second quarter profit more than doubled thanks to higher passenger traffic and capacity. The Chinese government says that its population of Internet users has jumped by 20% over the past year to 123 million users. The Marriott hotel chain says that it will make all of its properties in the U.S. and Canada non-smoking beginning in September. The new policy will affect 2,300 hotels and nearly 400,000 rooms. And Fox Television has announced that it will launch a one-hour morning news program in January that will air at 9 a.m. in most markets. Light sweet crude oil is trading this hour at $72.20 a barrel. That's down $1.34 a barrel. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 170 points. NASDAQ is up 31, and the S&P 500 is higher by 20. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 past the hour.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to know, and some of the news the government just has a hard time handling right now. Of course, the big news is what's going on in the Middle East, the ongoing war between Israel and Iran's proxy, the Hezbollah, and to a lesser extent, Hamas down in Gaza. And I've talked about that a lot. I will continue to talk about it. How can you not talk about it? One of the things that I read, interestingly, in the newspaper today from a retired Israeli army colonel, he said that Israel is attempting to create a rift between the Lebanese population and Hezbollah supporters by exacting a heavy price from the elite in Beirut. The message is, if you want your air conditioning to work and if you want to be able to fly to Paris for shopping, you must pull your head out of the sand and take action towards shutting down Hezbollah land. And I do think that any nation has to have self-defense. It cannot be the wrong idea for any nation, when hit with missiles, when its citizens are kidnapped, to go in and respond. But I agree, there's no easy answer. There's absolutely no easy answer here, and at some point Israel may even have to reoccupy Lebanon in order to get rid of Hezbollah. At least this time, they pretty much have the whole world behind them. Even the Europeans, even France supported the Security Council resolution 1559, saying that Lebanon has to retake its country, and I'm sure that if Israel were to conquer it, they would turn it over to the Lebanese army, in a minute, as long as Hezbollah was gone. Even the Arab countries are quietly criticizing Hezbollah, something you don't see very often. It's a tough situation, but I want to ask you this. With all the discussion of this war, and it is an important war, a geopolitical war, has what's going on in Iraq been put to the sidelines? I read in the newspaper today that some 237 Lebanese have died, most of whom civilians. Frankly, it's hard to know if that's true or not. I remember back in the second Intifada, people were talking about the Jenin massacre, when Israel went into Jenin, according to Palestinian sources, and massacred men, women, and boys, turned out to be absolutely false. Just complete made up. The UN itself came in and admitted that all those things were false. So I don't know what's true and what's not true. But what I do know is that in Iraq, this month, 3,000 civilians died. 3,000 a month. That's more than 100 a day. How many civilians have died just from January to July of this year, in 06, in just half a year? 14,338, according to the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq. 15,000, that's 30,000 a year. So while I feel for the deaths on both sides, Lebanese civilians who are caught up in a crossfire because their democratic government can't seem to get around to saying, hey, we don't want this private army on our border, or the Israeli civilians that are being rained with these missiles provided by Iran, the levels in Iraq are much, 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 much larger because Iraq is a civil war. They're killing each other. Shiites are killing Sunnis. Sunnis are killing Shiites. 3,000 in a month, 100 a day. More people are dying in Iraq right now than are dying in Lebanon and Israel combined. I guess the press is tired of Iraq. We've talked about it a lot. It's kind of boring. 2,500 Americans are dead. 15,000 in 6 months. Again, I do not mean to lessen the conflict going on in Israel and Lebanon. I will continue to talk about it. In fact, I'm even hoping to give you some news from the front. But let's not forget what's going on in Iraq. An ongoing, very broad civil war, and we're caught up in the middle of it, not really knowing who to support. Elsewhere in the news, we've got, of course, George Bush and his love attack on the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Did you see this? It was in the newspaper. It was also played on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. George Bush, in his wonderful chauvinistic way, I guess feels that all women need a back rub, including the German Chancellor. So he went up to her at the G8 convention and laid his hands on her neck, causing her to immediately jump with a start and put her hands up to protect herself. Kind of, I guess, like what you'd see in one of those self-defense videos. And George Bush quickly moved away. George, just a little bit of advice from me. Don't give back rubs to women if you haven't asked them first. Just a little bit of idea, particularly when they happen to lead an entire nation. not the best idea. One of the interesting things in the news that I found, very few people are talking about, and after all, that's what I'm hired to do, give you the news the government doesn't want you to know, is the cover-up of the obstruction of justice that the administration has personally done, gone all the way up to George Bush, to prevent the Justice Department from investigating the illegal wiretapping. Now, let's back up here, okay? We know, because the New York Times, after waiting a year in cowardice style, in my view, but finally printing that the United States is spying on all of us. The National Security Agency, we now know, is spying on 225 million Americans, just about everyone except those of you that have Quest, finding out who you're talking to, when you're talking to them, all those details. Well, the Justice Department knew that that was illegal. You have to understand, the Justice Department, it's run by Attorney General Gonzalez. You know, Mr. Geneva Conventions are quaint and torture is not such a bad deal, Gonzalez. But I happen to know some people in the Justice Department. Heck, I got some sources in the Justice Department. The Justice Department is full of mostly career lawyers who believe in the rule of law, who believe in the Constitution, who are doing their best. Yes, they're controlled by political hacks at the top, but there are longtime public servants there that are just trying to do their job. And one of those public servants is a man by the name of Glenn Fine. He is the Inspector General for more than 31 years, okay, more than three decades, dating back to the 70s. The Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department watches itself. It's a self-enforcing police organization, if you will, to make sure that it's following the law. So we have a president that's made it clear that Congress can't intervene in what it's doing. It wants to wiretap without a warrant. Congress, according to the administration, gave permission for that when they said we should do self-defense in Afghanistan. Funny, I've read that bill. Mentions nothing about wiretapping 75% of Americans. But that's the administration's position. Congress has no role in this. Go away. The president's commander-in-chief. He can do whatever he wants. And his position is the courts. Can't do anything about this. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, yes, requires a search warrant along with probable cause of commission of a crime before you do eavesdropping, but the administration's position is courts stay out of it. The Bill of Rights doesn't apply to us. What's interesting is that they're also covering up amongst themselves. I mean, the checks and balances of our government, when they work, are really amazing stuff. Again, you have Congress and the courts and the executive branch all watching each other, but you also have protections within the executive branch, and one of them is this Inspector General's office. Specifically, an office called the Office of Professional Responsibility. They handle internal affairs at Justice. It is their job to investigate when people break the law, including when people break the law at the highest levels. Well, they went in to investigate the NSA wiretapping program. And even Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez won't say that was a bad idea, but he was overruled by the president himself. The president himself blocked the investigation, refusing to give the surveillance security clearances that they needed to investigate. Now, the Inspector General has investigated everything, like I said, for the past 30 years, and they've always gotten security clearances they need. No one challenges the patriotism of these people. They work in the Justice Department, for God's sake, right? They're in the nation's highest lawyers, but they're not allowed to investigate. This, my friends, is a cover-up of the highest order. It reminds me very clearly of what happened when Richard Nixon fired, in what was known as the Saturday Night Massacre, the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, right? This is the government refusing to allow dedicated government servants to investigate itself just to see if whether it's committing an illegality. And my friends, where there's smoke, there's fire. Why doesn't the president want an investigation? The purpose of the investigation is just to determine if anyone's breaking the law. When the president himself overrules a lawful investigation, then it's clear that the president himself knows he's breaking the law. He has to be breaking the law, because if he didn't, he would allow the investigation. What's interesting in this is that even Alberto Gonzalez seems frustrated by the president going over his head. This is unprecedented. But it's not on the front pages. Like I said, I understand there's a war in the Middle East. I've talked about it. I understand there's a war in Iraq. But when the President of the United States refuses to allow Justice Department investigators to find out what's going on, well, I'm afraid That's obstruction of the highest order, and it should be on the front pages. What else is happening in Washington? Well, the President of the United States has determined to issue his first veto ever. This president has not vetoed a single bill, not the Bridge to Nowhere, not any bill on anything, whether it's massive subsidies to oil companies, anything else, this president has not vetoed. Well, he's going to issue his first veto, and his first veto might well be issued today, maybe tomorrow, is the bill passed by both houses of Congress to allow federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Now, of course, stem cells are, well, almost magical things, particularly embryonic stem cells, because how are we formed? Well, you have a fertilized egg, and all of us come out of a single cell. And these stem cells, at the very earliest stage, and I'm talking about the first 14 days after an embryo is fertilized, back when it's a blastocyst, it's not even an embryo yet, these cells can become anything. They can become neurons in the brain. They can become blood cells. They can become muscles. They can become bone. They can become anything. And most scientists, including a scientist I've often criticized, a doctor by the name of Bill Frist of Tennessee, who has sold out on any number of issues. I mean, he's the guy, remember, who did not want to admit in public that AIDS could not be contracted via saliva, did not want to admit in public the obvious, which was that Terri Schiavo was brain dead, actually. He saw a video and said, oh, yeah, she's fine to me. But even Dr. Frist understands the power of these stem cells. I mean, imagine not needing a heart transplant because you can use a stem cell to grow a new one. When I get back from break, I want to talk about stem cells and about the veto of this legislation and why I think that this is really the president's theocracy gone wild. And then coming up at the end of the hour, I want to play an interview on how the Democrats are doing in 2006. All of that and more in your calls, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, right after this.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided they can't be with it, that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
Hi, you've reached the Johnsons. We're not available to take your call. If you're calling about the apartment for rent, please leave your name and number after the beep and someone will get back to you.
Hi, my name is Sanjay Rana. I would like to make an appointment to see the apartment.
Oh, hi, this is Robin DiPaola, and I'm calling about the apartment. Please give me a call back at 2.
Hi, hello. This is Rafael Paredes. Please call me back at 718.
This is Jeannie Chu. I'd like to talk to you about the apartment. If you can please call me back.
Hello, my name's Clayton Anderson. I'm calling about the ad in the Sunday paper.
Oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson. You must be calling about the apartment.
I am. Is it still available?
Well, you're the first person to call about it. Are you available?
Housing discrimination of all kinds is illegal in the U.S. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
Did you receive an email from the IRS saying you're due a tax refund? If so, don't open it. The IRS does not request personal information by email. Hello, I'm Russell George, Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration. The IRS and I want to warn you about bogus IRS emails and websites that look real but are not. These emails are schemes played by crooks who are out to steal your money and identity. Fall victim to it, and you can spend months, even years, cleaning up the mess they've made of your good name and credit record. Help stop these crooks from ripping people off. If you get a suspicious email, go to IRS.gov and search for identity theft to find out what to do. That's IRS.gov. Or call us at 1-800-366-4484. Again, that's 1-800-366-4484.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. If you want to call in and comment on anything I'm saying, agree or disagree, the toll-free number is 888-488-6275. That's 888-488-MARK. Also, you can comment on the web at radioinsidescoop.com. We always appreciate your comments there. And if you just want to talk amongst yourselves, go to headonradio.com/chat and y'all can comment to yourself on the program. I was talking about stem cell research. It's very interesting to me that this would be Bush's first veto. It's really kind of shocking, actually, when you think about it, all the bills that he didn't veto, and he wants to veto this one. Now, there's been some discussion on the blog, and I do read your comments on the blog, a lot of it, in fact, under the show, my debate that occurred yesterday, Monday night, in fact, on this issue. And Vicky writes that much can be achieved with the use of adult stem cells. No human being has ever been cured of a disease using embryonic stem cells. Adult stem cells, on the other hand, have already cured thousands. Using embryonic stem cells shouldn't be an issue. And Vicky, I appreciate your argument, but we all know what's going on here. You don't like the use of embryonic stem cells because you are of the pro-life school that believes that every fertilized egg is, I guess, equivalent in human dignity to you and me. But it's a life, and it cannot be destroyed even to save another life. And while I certainly would not kill a child to give its bone marrow to save another child, I have no hesitation about destroying an embryo that will be destroyed anyway in order to save a child's life. Look, what embryos are we talking about here? Well, in the Clinton administration, they gave some very clear restrictions. They have to be embryos that are used in fertility treatments. You know that when people go to get a fertility treatment, they create dozens of fertilized eggs because it doesn't always work. People who have fertility problems often need implantation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. They need to make a lot of them. The process of extracting eggs from a woman is quite painful. Instead of making her go into pain 7, 8 times, they extract more than is necessary, fertilize them, and freeze them. Well, these eggs, there are now more than 400,000 fertilized embryos that are frozen right now. Out of those 400,000, how many have been adopted by some real strong pro-life advocates who believe that these are 400,000 human beings locked away in a frozen wasteland? True, they're no bigger than the point that when you click your pen. And of course, they can't think or feel or anything like that. But if they're equivalent to human lives, why isn't Jerry Falwell adopting one? Well, out of the 400,000, 128 total have been adopted. 128 have been adopted, and 99.98%, something like that, are going to be destroyed. Now, what kind of advocacy is it that says that you can't save a child's life or an adult's life with something that is going to be destroyed anyway? Again, under the Clinton administration, these were only those used in fertility treatments and donated by the couple themselves. who no longer needed them. So the couple themselves have said, we want to give this fertilized embryo in order to save other people's lives. Well, Bush declared, as you may know, in 2001, that he would allow only the colonies that have already been created during the Clinton administration to be used and no more. He said at the time there were 60 or 70 of them. Turns out there's 24. Only 24 lines. And most of them are contaminated with animal blood products. A number of them are not aging well. It's been 7 or 8 years. They're accumulating mutations and other defects. And it's also harming private. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, you'd say, well, okay, this is just federal funding. Why can't the private group do it? The reason is because scientists work together. And the private group has to very carefully manage its strains so that it doesn't mix with the 24, and they can't mix the research together, and that harms everybody's research. So in answer to Vicky's point, which is, well, why haven't embryonic stem cells been used? The answer is Bush stopped or severely impaired most of the research. As Bob points out, scientists first learned how to isolate human embryonic stem cells only in 1998. Adult stem cell research is much older. The cells are simpler to deal with. So it's not surprising that adult stem cells are used for more. But the difference is that embryonic stem cells, which can become any cell, may someday be used, as Bob points out, to treat Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injuries, Alzheimer's, stroke, skin burns, arthritis, birth defects, diabetes, and heart disease. It's a very powerful thing. And I think this should be reviewed by science. If scientists say this won't work, then scientists say it won't work. That's fine. That's up to scientists to decide. But when you have promising research that can save people's lives, I don't see how you can avoid it. Particularly when you're talking about things that are going to be destroyed anyway. Toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. Feel free to call in. And if we don't receive any calls, I want to go right away to an interview right after the break with Tom Schaller, who has a very interesting book out called Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South. And we'll get to that interview and your calls right after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Listen, man. Adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
No. You just gotta find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4 and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers so that becomes an 8 too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
The Native American Journalists Association is calling out to tomorrow's reporters, photographers, editors, and publishers to represent Native perspectives.
Today's agreement allows the Nebraska State Patrol and Winnebago Tribal Police to share enforcement.
The tribe is taking its concerns to the Bureau of Reclamation, which manages and
Native American inmates have filed suit against the prison.
Go to NAJA.com to learn more about membership and benefits. NAJA, raising the next generation of storytellers.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. As we're fighting theocracy all around the globe, our president wants to bring theocracy here at home. It seems that he is against the civil war in Iraq, when you have Shiites and Sunnis at each other's throats, and he certainly doesn't like the Shiite Muslims in South Lebanon that are attacking Israel, that are sponsored by Iran and all the ferocity there. But at home, he thinks we need more theocracy, and that's why, of course, the administration is threatening its very first veto ever, its veto on embryonic stem cell research to be federally funded, something that has wide support among the American people because it can save lives. And it seems to me that if someone dies, 14-year-old, 18-year-old, 30-year-old, 60-year-old, or gets Alzheimer's, or has Parkinson's disease, and can't be cured because you're trying to, I don't know, protect the sanctity of 400,000 frozen points on a pen that are going to be discarded anyway? That makes no sense to me. That's a theocracy. And it also doesn't make any sense that the House of Representatives voted on the Federal Marriage Amendment. Now look, that had already been rejected by the Senate. It had already been rejected, changing our federal constitution to prevent gay people from getting married. And what's interesting about this issue is that no one I've ever heard has been able to defend the issue for some non-religious reason. Yes, you could say my religion says that gay people are less than human and therefore should be persecuted. Okay, that's your religion. But no one can ever express a logical view. And I want you to know, I've invited them on this program. In fact, I just called James Kennedy. His branch, his church, someone who's been praising all over the internet and all over congressional hearings, praising treating gay people as second-class citizens, but of course they weren't willing to debate me either, and that's because they know that their position is illogical. It makes no rational sense, particularly when we're fighting theocracy all the way around. But what's interesting is that the Democrats, should they reject this kind of stuff? I mean, a lot of people think the Democrats need to at least play to those voters who believe in some religious-controlled government. Now, let me be the first to say that a lot of religious people, and I count myself among them, do not believe that the church should control the state. We believe in the separation of church and state. There are plenty of liberal Democrats out there who are church-going people. There are plenty of church-going people who understand that when the government intervenes in church proceedings, it's just as bad as when the church intervenes in government proceedings, and they want to stay out of it, and I respect those people. And what's interesting is a lot of this comes out of the South. The South is the most conservative part of the country. The South is the region of the country that most wants things like government-sponsored prayer, most wants things like the Ten Commandments to be in government buildings. And lately, Democrats have not been doing too well in the South. As you may know, for a long period of time, Democrats were doing best in the South. That was back when the Republicans were the party of freeing the slaves, and Democrats were the party of the Confederate States. That time is long gone with the Civil Rights era. And now we see just the opposite. We see John Kerry almost winning the presidency in 2004 without the South. But should the Democrats discard an entire region of the country? Howard Dean doesn't think so. But my guest, someone I interviewed just a few weeks ago, thinks so. His name is Tom Schaller, and he's the author of a new book called Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win without the South. It's a very provocative title. It's a very provocative theory. And I want to play for you my interview with Tom Schaller.
My next guest is Tom Schaller, and he's the author of a new book coming out by Simon & Schuster called Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South. Tom, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark.
So it seems to me that, I mean, your book's pretty controversial. In some sense, I guess it's obvious. I mean, had John Kerry won Ohio, he would have won without the South. On the other hand, as Howard Dean has pointed out, you know, Democrats should run a 50-state campaign, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, as you pointed out, not only Kerry could have won the Electoral College if he got Ohio while losing the popular vote, but Al Gore, but for about 7,000 votes, could have won New Hampshire and won without any Southern electors, and he's a Southerner. If you look across American history, there used to be a time when the Republican Party was the non-Southern party. The Democrats owned the entire South, and yet they were the minority party. The Republicans had majorities and won 14 out of 18 presidential elections from the Civil War till the New Deal with almost no Southern support. So there's a historical analog. More importantly, what people don't realize is that if you chart the share of House and Senate seats and electoral votes in the South, it's been consistent for 130 years. As populations moved out of the Northeast and the Midwest, it's really moved out to the West. So the South has no more political electoral clout than it did 100 years ago. So I think it's numerically possible. And I also think it's ideologically probable that the most conservative region, the most conservative states, the Deep South and even the Outer South, is the place where you would end your majority, not start your majority. So I'm not talking about writing off the South forever. I'm just basically saying that you're going to build a majority outside the South, and when you get to Alabama, the only thing left to decide on election night is whether you're going to win 45 states or 49 states. Let's figure out how to win 29 or 39 before we start thinking about winning 49.
Well, I don't doubt that you're numerically correct. I mean, there's no question that if you sort of add up all the electoral votes, but doesn't it make it really tough if we don't at least contest the South? Let me ask you this first of all. You don't consider Florida the South, I don't.
No.
Okay.
What I ask people to think of is what I call the Democratic Diamond, and I say take your finger and draw a line from Cleveland, northwest to Helena, Montana, southwest to Las Vegas, southeast to Tucson, and back to Cleveland. And that diamond has about 20 states. And that's really the state of the play. The Midwest has been the most competitive region for the last 60 years. The Southwest is the real opportunity for Democrats, especially with the influx of Latinos and Hispanics. And the Interior West has a strong libertarian streak. Its conservatism is different than the South. And that's starting to become in play, as we've seen in Montana and some other
places.
Yeah,
but you don't think we can win Kansas, Nebraska, Dakotas,
no,
Idaho?
I think we're going to have a hard time in Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah, certainly. But anyway, so that's the diamond, and then I call Florida the setting to the diamond. And Florida is the most competitive region in the South. Why, Mark? Because it has the least Southerners.
That's right.
So Florida is sort of the exceptional case. And when you remove Florida from the calculus, by the way, the South has fewer electoral votes than it did 150 years ago.
Tom, I'm actually from Nashville, Tennessee.
Are you?
So I can tell you that we never considered Florida part of the
South. Right, yeah, sure.
Except the Panhandle region,
exactly.
which is not the majority of the state. But I guess one of the things that concerns me is back when the Democrats did have the Solid South, back when it was the Segregationist Party, which, of course,
sure.
it no longer is, it seems to me that it was seen as a sectional party, as the party of the South, and not seen as a national party. And I wonder if by excluding the South, Southerners, will write off the Democrats in all kinds of ways that we care about. For example, there might be in Nashville, Tennessee.
Sure.
That congressional seat is Democratic. There are plenty of congressional seats throughout the South, Atlanta, that have Democrats. There are plenty of local state legislatures in Georgia and I believe Arkansas, Oklahoma. There are a number of states that are very conservative that have state legislatures. And if we write off the South electorally for the president, don't we fear that we're going to lose some of these state races and even congressional races that we need?
I mean, I think that's a fair enough point, but the strange thing about it is that the problems that are endemic for the Democrats in the South actually stem from the down-ballot problems. The racial gerrymandering in the South is so severe, Mark, that if you're an African-American in the South, there's no reason for you to turn out, and except maybe if there's a Democratic primary challenge. There's no reason to vote for your state legislator because 90% of black state legislators in the South win by 60% or more, and 60% win by 90% or more. There's no reason to turn out for your black congressional race because that's a whitewash, so to speak, because there's no competition in the general election. And then there's no reason to really turn out in the presidential race because you know the Republicans are going to win statewide. So the strange thing is the Republicans have not only boxed in all the African Americans and the Latinos in places like Texas and Florida into a handful of districts that minimizes their power, but because they do, it discourages black and Latino turnout, and it helps them win in their statewide races. So, yes, I would like to see some re- redistricting. I would like to see some more competitive challenges down ballot. But as it sits right now, that's going to be very, very difficult. But I understand your point that there's a lot of other races besides the presidential race. But the fact of the matter is, most of the Democrats from the South are minorities, and the few whites who are left are among the most endangered targets. In fact, the Republicans only have 11 targets this year in the House that they are looking at. Six of them are in the South. So the Democrats are actually defending seats down there, not going after seats.
Of course, Tom, Bill Clinton won Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, and he didn't
Florida.
Win all the western states. Well, of course, Florida.
In 96 right. And Georgia in 92, right?
And he didn't win all the western states, like we discussed. Right. He's never going to win Utah, Wyoming. They didn't even win Nebraska, Kansas,
he won Montana,
Dakota.
In 92,
he did
yeah.
win Montana. Again, I wonder. I mean, we have a lot of... There are Southern Democrats. You know, I personally, I'd like to see Al Gore win again,
sure.
run again,
me
although
too,
he didn't win his own state. I just wonder about, if you write off the South, whether the Democrats will be seen as a regional party rather than a national party.
Well, what's interesting is that the Republicans, with impunity, Mark, constantly vilify Northeastern liberals.
That's
now,
true.
Imagine if Democrats came out and vilified Southern conservatives. There would be this media backlash about how can you denigrate, how can you vilify, how dare you? These are the real Americans. But apparently Northeastern liberals are not real Americans. What they do very magnificently, though, is they say Northeastern liberals. They don't attack the entire Northeast. And what I suggest is that Democrats need to talk about the conservative South. You know, a year ago when Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, one of the most conservative states, and I would argue it's the Republican Massachusetts, it's the most conservative state in America, the state that they least want to be identified with and juxtaposed with. When Lindsey Graham was questioning Donald Rumsfeld before the Senate, he says, you know, people are starting to wonder about this war in my state, the most patriotic state in America. What he didn't tell you is that in South Carolina until the 1950s, whites didn't celebrate the 4th of July. That was a black holiday. They celebrated Confederate Memorial Day. And you never hear that from the Sean Hannitys. You never hear that from the Bill O'Reillys, that this is the most conservative region. It blocked child labor laws. It blocked the Women's Suffrage Amendment. It blocked every progressive change in the history of the country. And if the Democrats can't stand against that, Mark, what the heck can they stand against?
But, see, I guess my question is,
why are we afraid to define our opponents?
I don't mind if you're arguing to me that we need to put more money into Ohio than Alabama. I don't think you'll get much
sure.
argument there. But at the same time, as a Democrat from the South, you know, I worry about writing off... I mean, we have a Southern governor in Tennessee that's a Democrat,
Phil Bredesen.
You know, yeah, Arkansas Warren, has Kane. Three out of four, you know, congressional seats. Louisiana has Mary Landrieu. And
sure.
So, you know, maybe the deep South. I mean, Alabama and Mississippi won't get much argument with me, but there's all kinds of border states in the South that let me ask you this. In your strategy, how Democrats can win without the South, how do you propose that we... to use a term, write off the South without writing off the South. I mean, I think you can agree that it doesn't really, or maybe you don't, it doesn't do any good politically to say we are writing off the South. I mean, to use those words seems, I mean, you never hear Republicans say we're writing off the Northeast.
I don't think you have to announce the strategy to do the strategy.
So what is the strategy exactly? Is it monetary? Is it resources? When you say, what is
our policy and issue and ideology? I mean, geographically, as I said, one of the things that's amazing is that I use the metaphor of a tree and trying to fill a fruit basket from that tree. Now, if you were trying to fill a fruit basket efficiently as possible, because politics is really economics, right? It's about using your resources as efficiently as possible, right? Because Republicans have the thinnest of majorities. We can both agree to that.
That's
They're very shrewd and they're very efficient about maximizing their votes and using gerrymandering and what have you.
And making sure blacks can't get to the polls.
Of course, right? So... the lowest hanging fruit, in fact, I would suggest it's windfall and fruit at your feet already, just ready to be picked up and put in the basket, is actually in the blue states. What most Americans don't realize, Mark, is that the Democrats have fewer seats in the Northeast in the House and in the Senate and fewer governors than the Republicans have in the South. But you always hear the Democrats referred to as a Northeastern party. You're much more likely, less likely to hear the Republicans referred to as a Southern Republican Party, even though they have a higher share of the seats in the South than the Democrats have in the North. That's
so,
a fact.
Let me just get this straight. You're saying that there's a greater percentage of Northeastern seats held by
Republicans than there are
Democratic seats in the South.
It's 62% of the House seats in the Northeast, and I'm talking about from Maine to Maryland, are held by Democrats. 63% of House seats in the South. In the Senate, it's not even close.
I wonder if that's because of the Pennsylvania gerrymandering that just happened.
Some of it's about Republicans, moderate Republicans, who have figured out a way to win, and they're most of the targets. In fact, of the 59 vulnerable Republican seats that have that were either carried by Kerry or Gore or carried almost by a little bit by Bush, of those 59 seats in the country, 44 of them are between Dover, New Hampshire, Dover, Delaware, Des Moines, Iowa, and Duluth in that rectangle. There's only 8 seats in the entire South and four in Florida. The state of play is in the Northeast and the Midwest and then down into the Southwest. So anyway, continue my metaphor. The Midwest is sort of the low-hanging fruit that you can reach without a stool. Southwest is the opportunity. It's up in the middle of the tree. And then finally is the South, and especially the deep South, at the top of the tree. And if you're going to fill your basket efficiently, why would you go to the top of the tree when there's all that fruit in between?
So you're arguing that basically monetary resources and ads and things like that need to be focused on this low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, if Eisenhower said we're going to attack on D-Day by covering every single square inch of the French coast with the equal amount of troops spread across, we'd all be speaking French right now. You target where you can win. You consolidate your resources where you can win. And then when you win, this is the key. You govern in a strong, progressive way, and then you take that record of achievement to the South, and at some point they're going to say, hey, these guys are getting it right. What you don't do is go to rural, white, male, Christian, married Southerners who are declining market share, right? With each passing election, Mark, women, seculars, the unmarried, minorities and so forth are an increasing share of the election with every 4 years, and yet we have people like Mudcat Saunders and these Southern consultants who say we have to go after the Southern white conservative family Christian evangelized male vote. It's absurd. It would be like me telling you that to invest all your money in pets.com. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, so do you basically criticize Howard Dean and his strategy?
No.
Or do you,
people have asked.
Howard Dean is the one who's saying, you know, in fact, he got in trouble in the primary saying we need to talk to people that have gun racks and Confederate flags.
Right.
And he, of course, has been to every state, has been to Alabama. But maybe that's all words. Maybe he's putting the resources at the low-hanging fruit.
No, people have said, who's right? Rahm Emanuel, who says we got to target where we have opportunities, or Howard Dean, who is covering a blanket sort of strategy across all 50 states. And I say it's a false dichotomy. It's not a mutually exclusive choice. What Dean is doing is saying, look, if we have to reinvent the wheel, and I'm one of the few political scientists in this country who's worked on a field campaign. I worked on a field campaign in Maryland for Gore in 2000. So I know what it's like to organize volunteers. I know what a vote goal is. I know how you target.
Tom, that's a pretty easy goal, right?
Yeah, sure.
Maryland for Gore.
Right. But still, how many political science professors, how many media consultants, how many people have ever worked on a field campaign? And the thing that you learn in a field campaign, at the end of the year, at the end of the election, everything gets put in a box and it ends up in somebody's basement. And then 2 years later, the new field coordinator, because they're all 24-year-old people, come rolling out and they say, well, who knows what's going on in Baltimore County? Who knows what's going on in Calvert County? Who knows what's going on in Western Maryland? And you restart the wheel from scratch. What Dean's brilliance is he's saying, look, if we have a permanent staff that turning over and can teach the new staff as they come in, we're not going to have to reinvent the wheel. It's a matter of efficiency. Now, if he said, I want to put equal amount of resources in all 20 people in all 50 states, I'd say he's crazy. But a minimum floor of people is a very smart strategy. And Rahm is also right. As you get close to the election, you see which states, which regions, which districts, which Senate races or House races or even in state legislative races are close. And then at the last minute, you funnel your resources there.
One of the things that you pointed out that I've been talking about with my listeners for years now is that in some ways, the real battle is the state legislatures because it's all about gerrymandering. And they have out-gerrymandered us. I saw in 2000, even though Al Gore won the popular vote,
right,
he won 42% of congressional districts.
Right.
And that was before the great gerrymandering of Pennsylvania and Texas,
sure,
and so forth. So as I said to my listeners, in order for us to win in November 2006, we got to win more than 60% of the vote to get 50% of the seats. What do you think the Democratic Party is doing, and should they be doing more to win back state legislatures so we can re-gerrymander seats? Tom DeLay changed the practice for good or for ill.
I argue largely
for ill, but it used to be we only redistricted every 10 years. Tom DeLay has said, no, we need a permanent election. He did that for Texas, and now the only way to fight fire is with fire. Do you think we're doing enough to win those state legislatures back and to gerrymander those seats back so that we have a decent chance in the House of Representatives?
No, I agree with you completely. And there are groups like Progressive Majority and so forth that are starting to focus on the subnational races, and I think that's very smart. So, yes, recapturing some of these state legislatures, which are moving in our direction, right? In the last cycle, we picked up...
Colorado,
eight,
I know.
We picked up eight chambers, seven of which, of course, were outside of the South. North Carolina's House, I think, was the only southern one. And we lost four chambers. We lost Oklahoma, Indiana, and two southern legislatures. So, net, we gained four, and most of it was outside the South, not to hook it on that. But your general claim is exactly right. And more to the point, the governors that are elected in 2006, right, because most of the governors, 25 or 30 seats, are elected in off-presidential years. Those governors will be standing for re-election in 2010. And it is the governors who are elected in 2010 that will be in charge of the redistricting. And being re-elected when you're an incumbent is much easier than winning an open seat or as a challenger. So strangely enough, the battle for the redistricting, which will take effect in January of 2013, begins on November 7, 2006.
Very interesting. Let me ask you this, a bottom line. Are we going to win? Are we going to win the House?
I
What's your prediction?
I don't think we're going to win the House. My prediction right now.
You don't?
No, really?
I think that's bad. That's sad to hear.
No, and I think it's a very affirmative sort of tailwind cycle for the Democrats. But I think the gerrymandering is an incredible institutional obstacle for Democrats to capture seats, as we saw with Francine Busby's race and so forth. A lot of things working in her favor. She made a couple stumbles at the end, but ultimately what matters is that district is carved out in a way to elect a Republican.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that seat. I mean, it's that's a San Diego seat you're
that's
talking
San
about.
Diego
where
seat.
You have Duke Cunningham. He's convicted of bribery.
Right.
You'd think that would be a perfect seat for the Democrats. Obviously, San Diego is California.
Right.
This is not exactly Republican territory, but it's been so gerrymandered.
Exactly.
That how close was that race?
I think the race was 4 points. So it's a moral victory, and it's closer than it should have been, and I think it still bodes well for the general election. But we're going to have a couple of races where we and hope we come up, and we're going to come up 3 or 4 points short. My prediction right now is somewhere between 9, 11, 12 seats. We'll get pretty close to half.
We need 15.
And we need 15, and I think we'll pick up 3 Senate seats, 2 to 4, probably 3. And the irony there is that it might actually work to our advantage. There's a lot of theories about if we get close but don't control anything, then Bush and the Republicans still have to answer about Iraq, and then we go into the 2008 election and we take it all.
Well, thank you very much for your analysis. It's very interesting. I think we agree on a lot of things. I the only thing about your book, and of course titles are always chosen to get the audience, is that as a Southerner,
sure,
who believes the Democrat Party can relive again, particularly because a lot of white Southerners are hurting economically.
Right.
Even the ones who are do not share my values in terms of they want the government interfering in people's private lives and so forth. They're hurting, and they need health care, they need education, and so Bill Clinton could find a way to reach those, and I'm hoping that we will have another Democrat, and I don't know if it's Hillary, probably isn't, but another Democrat who can reach them again. I still think it's possible, so I don't want to quite give up on
that,
but I don't think you are either.
Well, I look forward to the day where, and Tennessee's more of an outer or rim south state than a deep south state. I mean, I talk about in the book when you sort of establish a foothold in Alexandria, which is one of these sort of Rui Tejera progressive centrist pockets, and the Orlando-Tampa corridor and Austin as sort of your three outposts, and you start to work in the south from there. You get
there
the
you
outer
are.
South, and you work your way, and when you end up in the deep south of upcountry North South Carolina, you know, you, like I said, you're trying to figure out whether you're going to win 48 or 49 states, and I look forward to that day as much as the next person. But like I said, let's see if we can get 29 first. We won 19 basically the last two cycles. Let's get to 29, and then we'll start talking about flipping Tennessee back.
A very interesting analysis. Thank you, Tom, for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Great pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
A very controversial author saying some things that people say in private but rarely do talk about in public. Can the Democrats win without the South? We're going to take a quick break. If you want to call in, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and comment on the book, and then I'll come back and give you my last word. Right back after this.
James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from the inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is it's about the oil. And you actually, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, everything's going to be okay. That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Last year, one in five children was sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Inside Scoop, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Tom Schaller. I found it quite provocative. I think that Schaller says some things that Democrats only whisper. And why do we whisper it? I guess it's because we do not want to write off anyone. Maybe that's part of our liberal sensibility. We are the kind of, you know, people that believe, hey, we're right. We can logically defend what we do, and we can convince anyone from the most religious fundamentalist to the most, I don't know, the person most persecuted. I mean, really, we could affect anyone, and we don't want to write off people. I think the Republicans do a much better job of pretending not to write off people while actually writing them off. Clearly, it's the clearest example, I think, would be what they've done with blacks, where they show them, you know, at all the conventions, but actually don't do anything to help black people. I do have Bruce on the phone. Bruce, we only got a couple minutes, but what's your comment?
Great, thanks, Mark. I guess I'm struggling with the idea that, you know, that we write off the South. As a matter of fact, one of the things that, you know, that I think needs to happen is a concerted effort, a campaign, if you will, that would change the conversation, you know, through the South and try to, you know, because my view is that the value, you know, values that are American values, that are family values, are, for instance, a living wage. There's a huge living wage campaign going on in North Carolina right now.
Right.
They just raised the minimum wage here, but, you know, to, I think, $6 an hour here in North Carolina. It just went through the state legislature. There are a lot of progressives here in the South, but they're not getting the press coverage, you know, and the people who are getting the press coverage are people like Jeff Sessions or Lindsey Graham, and they are really more the minority than the majority based on, you know, my experience, and I'm in North Carolina.
Well, the question is, how can we join with people who are hurting with low wages or hurting with lack of health care? How do we persuade people that family values includes things like what Bill Clinton did, the Family Medical Leave Act, where people care for their families instead about persecuting other people's families? And it's hard, I think, to get that religious angle in there and do it just right. I mean, certainly Martin Luther King could do that. I think to some extent Bill Clinton can. But I think part of the way to go, and unfortunately we don't have enough time to really have enough of this conversation today. I hope you'll call me back another time, Bruce. But I think part of the way to go is to bring the Bible back. No disrespect to any atheists or anyone like that, but there are so many passages in the Bible about taking care of the poor and the widow and the orphan. People forget the Jubilee year where God required that every 49 years we redistribute the wealth and give some back to the poor. People forget how radical the Bible was, how radical Jesus' message was, that it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. And if we reclaim the religious heritage that supports progressive ideas, I think that's one way to get deeply religious people back looking at the Democratic Party again. Sorry, we don't have time to finish our conversation, Bruce. Please call back another time. But my time is up. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.